Jane Latour interviewing Janine Blackwelder on December 17th in Chesterfield, Massachusetts. So Janine, you spent 10 years in the trades, approximately. What was the date that you left?
I think it was the fall of 91, but actually I was about 12 years in Local 580. As an iron worker, although I took a year off from that and was a building inspector. But before that, I spent a little time as a pipe fitter welder for Amtrak at the railroad, maybe a year or so.
So did you keep your card when you left the union?
Well, yeah, I didn't give it up. They have an expression, putting it on the shelf or taking a withdrawal. And what that means is for, you know, some sum of money, $200 or $300, if I wanted to go back to work at it, I could do that. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, when you put it on the shelf, you don't have to pay union dues and you don't get any benefits either.
So you've got a withdrawal card.
Mm, right. Okay.
And what was the actual date that you left?
I don't know, maybe November of 91.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I'd like to do is talk about some of the things that you experienced then as a member of Local 580.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you had talked about was working with this network of people to try to open up things in terms of representation in the union.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the most recent election in the local and how you had actually had some impact. You said that the first black person was elected to union office and the first Puerto Rican,
mm-hmm.
and that you felt that you had, with the votes, you actually enlarged your voice. Could you talk about any of the results that you saw that came out of that election and that activity? How did that work out in terms of when they
got
in there?
I remember the election. I remember the meetings before the election and the fact that the minorities in the local were trying to vote as a block and have an effect that way. Alters was the name of the kind of coalition of minorities. Well, I guess you can't say coalition. That would refer to different groups within a group, but it was just, kind of a loose organization of individuals, and I don't really know, you know, as far as the results of the election, I don't really know how having these new individuals in office changed things.
Mm-hmm. Because you left shortly thereafter.
Right, right. Right.
So did ALTERS, was that an acronym? Did it stand for anything?
Yeah. Here, turn on the stop for a minute.
Okay, so the group, the network, was called ALTERS, and it was along the lines of...
Right, kind of an alliance for equal opportunity or to protect the rights of the minority individuals. I mean, I'm sure it was also an attempt for certain guys to ensure that they would stay employed themselves. Mm-hmm. For instance, this one guy who was the president of the group, he got a job pretty readily and stayed employed, mm-hmm. where, you know, some mm-hmm. other guys didn't. And, you know, in other words, I think that he had some opportunistic kind mm-hmm. of motivation mm-hmm. for being involved in the group too, mm-hmm. that he could negotiate a job for himself all the time, you know, by kind of using the group as leverage.
Yeah.
His name was Courtney something or other, I don't know.
And was he a minority or
he yeah
was
he was a black
dissident?
Guy from originally from uh-huh. Trinidad, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were you the only woman, or?
No, well, I was for the first couple of years I was in, and then a few women came and left, and a few stayed, and I really don't know how many women might be part of the union now. Mm-hmm. I don't think the union has a whole lot of work, so right. If there's any, it's probably just, you know, I would be surprised if there were more than 10 women involved.
Mm-hmm. So, when you left the union, did you tell the network that you were leaving? I mean, did you make it known to them?
Not really. They weren't really having very regular meetings, uh-huh. and I just kind of picked up and left. Uh-huh. And when I came up here, I remember sending a postcard to the secretary, and then it came back to me. So I guess he stopped using that post office box.
Yeah.
So I think that Lori Gallo, as she bumped into people, mentioned that I had gone up to Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But
So in the aftermath of the election, there was an upsurge of organizing activity amongst this network. I mean, they didn't sort of say, well, we made some gains, so now let's capitalize on it and build on it. Did you sense any of that?
There might have been something going on there. I think I remember Courtney organizing a bunch of guys to keep an eye on and protest not having union iron workers on some jobs or on one or two jobs in Brooklyn. But, you know, I don't know what else that they might have been doing. Mm-hmm. As I say, I think the regular meetings kind of fizzled out after the election, and some people were depending on Courtney to line up jobs for them and then griping that he was working and they weren't. So mm-hmm. I really don't know what else they did.
Built-in divisions.
Mm-hmm.
When you talked in your first interview in 91 about doing one-on-one organizing and talking to people about the meetings, and what kind of response did you receive? When was it pretty much, of course you would select the people that you were talking to, but basically did you find a good response to the idea that people were trying to change things and make a difference in the union? Or did you find passivity, cynicism? What was the basic kind of?
Well, I mean, it depends on who I'm thinking about.
Right.
You know, there
yeah.
was clearly a lot of cynicism on the part of black iron workers sitting in the hall waiting to go out on a job. But the thing is most of the talk about unions, I might have mentioned in the first interview, was done in bars. You know,
yeah.
and if you weren't there hanging out in the bars all the time, you weren't hearing the talk. Not that you were going to learn all that much in order to change things. I mean, I don't think people were too interested in change outside of the idea of getting their friend in as a business agent so they would be sure to go to work.
Yeah.
But I don't think there were any real burning issues or the idea of making the union more democratic or anything like mm-hmm. that really concerned people.
So despite the fact,
it was all a cronyism thing.
Yeah, the fact that the union wasn't democratic was more just something that was accepted. It's like a fact of life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what about you talked about organizing in a publishing house that you worked in before you went into
mm-hmm.
the trades, and what about the response of the union, District 65, to that organizing drive compared to the response of, like, working within 580 and any kind of interaction that you had? Did you find 65 responsive to the organizing drive?
Oh, yeah. When I first approached them, they were very interested in organizing in publishing and, you know, very helpful. They made up leaflets right away and came by the company and started distributing these flyers. And when we formed an organizing committee, you know, anybody who was a part of that could feel a part of trying to get change. Mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned in the first interview that what ultimately defeated the organizing drive was the fact that the company hired this powerful kind of anti-union organization to come in and give workshops and literature to people talking about how it would be to their disadvantage to have a union. And whereas in 580, I never felt a part of anything. You know, I felt very much as an individual, and I knew that as a woman, I wasn't ever going to have any big amount of influence. You know, if I had any influence, I had influence maybe just talking with Mike Simonelli, who eventually became the president and a business agent. You know, we had conversations, we were friends. In the Alters group, I could stand up and say why I was going to vote for one person or another, and I think that people heard me, and in fact, by me and this one other person, this fellow standing up and saying that we disagreed with supporting so-and-so, I think, you know, we swayed the group on the voting of for one individual. But it wasn't so much, no, it was more in favor of supporting a certain person, which I have heard since from Mike that he turned out not to be such a great business agent after all. But anyway, that was a change. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like I say, whatever political discussions went on, they went on in bars, and it wasn't appealing to really be in the thick of that all the time.
Right. What was the name of the publishing company? And who
Academic
was
Academic Press.
Academic Press. And who was your organizer for 65?
I can't remember her name, but uh-huh. At that time she was probably
like?
In her 60s.
Oh,
very heavy
Margie
smoker.
Albert?
Yes.
And she died of lung cancer.
Yes.
And she was a wonderful person.
Right,
yeah,
right.
She was terrific.
Right.
That's, and what year was that about?
Like 75, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So,
or 76, something like that. 75, I guess.
In your opinion, this is sort of a general question, but just what would you think it would take to change the building trades unions in terms of the membership's involvement and a different hiring system? That's the answer I always get. A different, not
right.
A monopoly on the jobs.
Right.
Is that?
I guess that's what,
that's the answer.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that 580, because, you know, they disobeyed the consent judgment in terms of apprentices and in terms of putting minorities to work, that they were finally coming around to some sort of a computerized system of sending people out on jobs that I think the government was going to monitor,
mm-hmm.
Right. So that would make the distribution of work more democratic. Mm-hmm. Now, what would it take to make decision-making more democratic? I don't know, because, you know, the whole tradition of the way the meeting is run, which for the most part, I guess, is already dictated by some you know, bylaws of the international. What do you read first? What do you read next? How to open discussion, follow Robert's rules. I don't think that too many of these guys had any other kind of organizational experience before they come to union meetings, and once they see how union meetings are run, they just, that's how they figure they're going to conduct business, you know. Mm-hmm. The idea that apprentices can't speak or vote, or you know, that the business agents have the floor for the most part to talk about what work they've tried to get or haven't been able to get. That's the, you know, there's not a whole lot of opportunity for other people to stand up and say things. And although there is an opportunity, but you find, like I said, a lot of guys, you know, they'll wait till they're drunk to express their beefs. There were only a couple people that you got the impression that they actually thought things out and were trying to work mm-hmm. toward changing a rule or changing something in the union, and they were somewhat articulate. But you know what? I don't know. I just yeah. you know I just think these guys don't have a clue. There's nobody to teach them.
Despite the fact that, in my experience, trade union people, I mean, union members in the building trades have very strong personalities, and they sort of like cowboys in the sky, and you know, doing this. Yet when they're in that union environment of that independence and sort of character traits on the job don't come into play in terms mm-hmm. of union.
Right. I mean, if I understand what you're saying, you know, where they might seem kind of on their own and rebellious or something, in the circumstance of a meeting, become pretty docile and deferring to whoever they see as their rabbi. And, you know, they have an expression, don't knock his jock off. In other words, if somebody's up there speaking like a business agent, you don't get up there and you don't stand up and question him or point out that he made a mistake. That if you want to have any kind of discussion, that happens sometime later in a bar somewhere.
Off the record.
I mean, I think the meetings became more participatory and interesting and more disciplined when Mike Simonelli started running the meetings. And I know he and this fellow Dennis both attended some sort of classes on labor unions, history of labor unions, and
were they
Robert's
at Cornell?
Rule. I don't know. I doubt it was Cornell. It could have been associated with
George Meany Center.
Wait a minute. It wasn't. Was it Cornell or somebody else who used that building next to the Port Authority bus terminal?
Empire State.
It might have been something that they were giving, or some other organization. Yeah. I can't remember right now.
Yeah.
But they did attend some classes, and I think, you know, Mike learned something with that anyway, in the way he ran meetings yeah. after that.
And so did you feel it sort of spreading? I mean, you actually saw some benefits from it in the...
Well, I think... Yeah, some people I don't know, you know, certainly some people were happy that he had the influence because they weren't getting preferential treatment from the other guy, but
yeah.
you know
yeah.
I mean, I appreciated that the meetings were being run better. I imagine other people did.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good. Okay. Well, you mentioned the consent decree and the fact that the government was supposed to be monitoring the way that people were being referred for work. And did you pretty much got the feeling that the government wasn't picking up its end in terms of really enforcing that agreement? And
well, that all was going to happen after I stopped working with 580, because mm-hmm. my last year in New York, in fact, I worked on permit with Local 40 on a bridge in the South Bronx. And I don't know if 580 had started that new program or not, even while I was in New York, because mm-hmm. I didn't really have much contact with them.
You had mentioned that you actually did stand up and challenge one of these business agents and
right.
sort of broke the unspoken rule. So could you tell me about that?
Well, he was spending a lot of time in court, partly to defend himself and the union against allegations that they continued discrimination of against minorities even after the judgment. But he also had this other problem going on where he was indicted with a bunch of gangsters for an issue about, in this case involving these non-union companies getting jobs installing windows. I think they might have, it might have been a big housing project or something having to do with the government.
New York City.
Yeah. Yeah, and so supposedly this business agent, Tommy McGowan, was taking payments for ignoring the fact that these jobs were being done non-union, and somehow in this were these mafia-type guys. I guess they owned the companies that were involved. And actually with the idea that he was spending a lot of time in court about the discrimination case, I stood up and I asked him to give up working on the territory of Brooklyn and Queens because there was work coming up there and it needed a lot of attention, and I pointed out that he was spending a lot of time in court. And I didn't mean to refer to his personal problem, but he took it as that and stood up and said that the best way for him to get through this period of time would be to stay busy, and he was doing a good job out there. And of course, his buddies in the audience clapped very loudly in support of him. I don't know if they actually booed me, but you know, kind of did the reverse to show me that I shouldn't have opened my mouth.
Keep your trap shut.
Right.
You had talked last time we were discussing this that you were just beginning to get to the point where you could relate to a middle class income, and you were just starting to get some stability in terms of your earnings.
Mm-hmm.
You also, I was wondering if you ever got to the point where you were feeling that you were getting some of the good jobs, some of the OT, some of the, you know, the jobs that would last a certain while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say all. I mean, I was on some jobs that were longer jobs, but when they reduced to a small gang just to finish up the job, I still hadn't gotten into any inner circle. This job I was on, the Shearson Lehman building, where I was good friends with the general foreman, or the main foreman on the job, unfortunately he had given the hire and firing power to his second in command, and it was that guy who laid me off as the job was winding down.
Shearson Lehman was in Brooklyn with Metro Tech?
No,
was that?
This
no?
was just below Canal Street, kind of overlooking the Hudson River, just north of Battery Park, mm-hmm. that whole financial
okay,
area, and just
yeah.
south of
mm-hmm.
Canal. And, I mean, I, you know, what was left to do was some of the finishing work inside. We had put up the outside skin of the building, and now there was some kind of decorative stuff. And,
the kind of work you like to
off.
Do.
Right, and which I was clearly good at, but you know, his buddy wanted to keep people who he could, you know, his own cronies, whatever. So I never got into an inner circle where I would really get the nicest work or stay the longest, be one of the people to stay throughout the whole job. Now, when I went and worked for the structural iron workers on that bridge, I was making real good money. With them, they had an extra annuity fund.
What local was that?
Local 40. So, I mean, in addition to the $23.50 or whatever it was that we were making an hour, there was another $10 or $12 in annuity funds and vacation. You know, so that was the best money I made. I think I made something like $40,000-$45,000 that year. And maybe the best I had made with 580 was 39.
Local 580 doesn't have an annuity fund?
Yeah, they have an annuity fund and a vacation fund, and it's pretty high compared to, like, the carpenters. Mm-hmm. But the Local 40 has something else called the topping out fund, which is an additional annuity fund. Oh. And each one is like $5 or $5.50 or something. So you're making another, $12, $13 an hour. Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that you had expressed frustration with was that you said that you would like to be able to run a job and be a foreman on a job and take charge of it. Mm-hmm. And did you ever get to do that?
Well, I only ran this one window job. I probably mentioned that to you. I don't remember seeing it in the interview, but that was kind of by default because this other guy who was supposed to run the job, he didn't like what the boss offered him. Maybe he asked for too many extras or something, so he got in his station wagon and drove away. And the boss told me that he was going to make me the foreman basically because I would do what I was told, and he wouldn't have to give me all these extras. He didn't say that, but I knew that. But, you know, as far as me being recognized for my skill or being tried out in different circumstances to take more leadership, that opportunity was not open to me. And that one job I ran probably, I don't know, we probably weren't there more than a month. And I don't really remember very well, but one of the biggest things I've thought about since I've been up here in Massachusetts in terms of my experience as an iron worker is that it was not good at all for my psyche, you know? And, to talk about the idea of women in the construction trades, I really think it's kind of a bad deal. Unless you're there with your relatives or your friends who you really like the men around you and are able to get support from them, and maybe there's women like that who could enjoy their time. But one of the striking things to me about my experience, with, you know, plenty of exceptions, but the dominant feeling was that you never get a pat on the back, you never get support. There were a lot of negative type people there, a lot of cynicism, a lot of wise guy attitudes, and, you know, friends that I had in other fields just didn't experience that in their work. For instance, my friend Stevie, who I still live with here in Massachusetts, she's a shiatsu practitioner. Everybody she deals with are nice people. They're grateful for what she does. If she's teaching, the students are grateful. Everybody is respectful of each other. And I didn't have that in my work environment. And I think it really takes its toll. I think that even though I'm a few years out of New York and that whole situation, I lack self-confidence, I lack self-esteem. I think that while I was in that situation, I learned to have this self-deprecating style that made it more comfortable for these men to have me around. And I just don't think I did myself any favors with that. Yeah. I'm also very insecure about jobs. Where I'm working now, which is doing telephone fundraising for progressive organizations, and environmental and Planned Parenthood and whatnot, I've been told that people rarely get fired from this job, and yet I have that insecurity. If I'm not performing well enough, I just feel like somebody's going to come and tell me, pick up your tools and leave, because you know, in the 580 situation, oftentimes I was replaced by somebody's brother or, you know, let go because the work was winding down. And like I said, I wasn't given the opportunity to finish up the job, so.
Well, I want to ask you about that in detail, but I would like to know if you, like, you experience frustration with not being able to run a job. Did you experience frustration in not being able to champion in a more outspoken way, like the situation for women and minorities? I mean, you did participate in that, what people were doing, and you had a very clear understanding that because, you know, minorities, you couldn't go too far too fast or mm-hmm. be out there too much. But was that frustrating for you?
I guess so.
What was the situation with women coming in? Did you hardly ever ran into other women working jobs?
Right, it was really rare that I would see them on a job. There was one gal, I was on the same job as her a couple times for a short time, and she was a very different type of person than I was. She had a boyfriend in the union, and they were both heavy drinkers and wild types. And I kind of hung around with her a little bit when I saw her on a job, but for almost all the years I was in, I didn't have another woman iron worker on a job with me. And, you know, you might bump into somebody in the union hall waiting to be sent out, and we'd chat a little bit, but there wasn't really very much contact at all.
And far cry from bonding or support. So I really want to learn about...
Well, excuse me, with the exception of Lori Gallo, who, you know, we had known each other, I believe, prior to being iron workers through United Trades Women. And so from time to time through the years, Lori and I have been on the phone.
Lori and your experience with her. What kind of, I'm interested in United Trades Women.
Mm-hmm.
And did that, while it was running, while it was alive, did it provide you with a lot of support?
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun too. We did some fun stuff, like had a fashion show with all our different work gear, and we put on a program about Rosie the Riveter, which I guess I kind of hosted, and this woman, I forget her first name, her last name was Weichsel.
Oh, Lola.
Lola, right.
Yeah.
You know, she came and spoke about her experience as a welder and
there's
aircraft.
There's a little shot of her in that film.
Uh-huh. Yes, right. Yeah. And that was a lot of fun. You know, we mm-hmm. dressed up. We had people come. One of the iron workers in 580, I bumped into him in the union hall years later. He was a black guy in his 30s. Maybe, and he was saying, oh, you know, I remember going to that program that you did, and I had forgotten he had even been there, mm-hmm. you know, and I had forgotten that we even had, like, co-workers and people, you know, Irene had some carpenters come, mm-hmm. and, you know, so it was a nice group, and so with those functions, and how we would get around together and complain about the bathroom situations or how we were spoken to or dirty pictures up in the shanty, you know, pornography or whatever. That was real good for that time. I think what I feel happened was, you know, we were just burning ourselves out energy-wise because people were attending apprentice classes as well as working. Some people had other classes or meetings to go to, and we were just running ourselves ragged. And I think, you know, it's real hard to have an organization like that, especially for those of us who were apprentices. So we had a lot of other things that we had to do, like go to these apprentice classes. And
which is very exhausting.
Yeah, had we gotten into it more after we finished our apprenticeship, I think it it could have gone on mm-hmm. longer, but I think people kind of dropped out just from exhaustion.
Yeah. They tried to organize along different ways, and they had coordinators for the different boroughs.
Yeah, I was the Brooklyn coordinator.
You were the Brooklyn coordinator.
Coordinator for uh-huh. a while.
Did that work any better? Did it? It was still the same problems of time and energy.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And do you consider yourself a leadership role in UT? Or?
For a while.
Yeah.
For a little while.
Yeah. Did you ever do any
but
work?
But I burnt out easy.
United Tradeswoman? I mean, New York Tradeswoman? Or that was later?
I don't think it was called... There was another one.
Barbara Trees?
Oh, no, that was later. Okay. Yeah, I used to get the flyers. I don't even remember going to one of their meetings.
Janine, tell me about the Night of Humor. You had, like, a comedy show? Did you go to that? Do you remember that?
You're not talking about the fashion show?
There was the fashion show, but there was also a follow-up to that. Was they organized a night of humor,
uh-huh.
and maybe it was to tell funny stories from on the job. Or
gee, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I remember the other organization that existed prior to UT. It was called Women in the Trades.
Right.
Which I attended some of those meetings uh-huh. Before UT formed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the predecessor to New.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe.
I think, yeah.
They existed around the same time.
Yeah, okay. But UT, a wonderful thing, but it died out
uh-huh.
due to exhaustion.
I think so. I don't know what yeah. Irene's take is on it.
Yeah, pretty much that.
Uh-huh.
Little personality differences and... some clashes.
Yeah, I think those personality differences came out when I had already fizzled out myself.
Yeah. People had put a lot into it, so mm-hmm. took it pretty personally, I think.
Mm-hmm. You want some tea?
No, thanks.
Would you like tea?
No, thank you.
Sure. We have donuts now. You want a donut with your tea?
Now, I want to talk about the departure from Local 580 and
uh-huh.
how you made that decision and how you decided to leave and what that's meant for you, what that's been like. So,
well, I think more than leaving 580, it was about leaving New York,
yeah,
you know.
Okay. Which
and
many
I had
people
wanted to leave New York yeah. for some time. And Stevie and I started taking turns coming up here to Massachusetts to look for some place to live in the country. And we chose Western Massachusetts because she wanted to be near her family, who's in Springfield. But I think, when I took the job as a structural iron worker, it wasn't so much to get away from 580, but that work was winding down. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get that job because that was one of the rare situations where the state was coming by and enforcing that there be some women on the job.
Because there was state money.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, our final departure from New York was expedited, I think, a little bit by the fact that this guy in the next building from us, but there were adjoined buildings in this co-op we lived in Brooklyn, where
right.
you and I
mm-hmm.
spoke on the roof.
Right.
Well, that if you came in the lobby, instead of taking the right-hand staircase, you took the left, it would lead you upstairs to an apartment of this guy who was brutally bludgeoned to death in his apartment. So here I had my business agent murdered, our next-door neighbor murdered, and, you know, we were just like, let's hurry up and do this deal and get the
yeah.
hell out of the city. You know, I think that made us move out a little quicker. But, you know, I had already been fed up with New York from 5 years before, and basically it was a matter of earning enough money to get out. It really had less to do with stopping being an iron worker. In fact, when I had come up here, if there was construction work, let's say, in Springfield, mm-hmm. where I could have gotten on a job right away, I probably would have done that,
mm-hmm.
At least for a while. But I went to the local union in this area, and the guy told me, you know, most of his members aren't working and forget it.
Not going to be any travelers.
Right. I mean, he was like, well, if something happens, I might give you a call, but I've got X number of guys who have been waiting for X number of years to get work.
Yeah.
You know, these people have been out of work a long time.
Yeah. So, what was your, when you think about the experience, what was your major emotional response to it? I mean, I realize a lot to say about that, but when you think about it, do you think of it as unfinished business, or you think of it as...
Oh, no, I don't at all feel it's unfinished business. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely a closed book for me. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've talked to Lori Gallo about. Mm-hmm. We've talked a few times since I've been up here in Massachusetts. And she was talking to me recently about, well, I don't know, maybe we spoke about 3 months ago or so. And she was again trying to get on a job with the structural iron workers because it was a lot of money. And Lori doesn't really know what she wants to do in life. And certainly without going to school, there's nowhere else she could go to earn that kind of money. But the last advice I gave her was, you know, you deserve something much better in life than putting yourself in a situation where some of the people are going to be hostile toward you, where you'll never have any influence, you know. And I just told her that, you know, that I thought that she should close the book on 580 and the structural iron workers. That here she had been to 580 meetings, even though she worked with the structural iron workers, she used to attend union meetings all the time with kind of this idealistic idea of what unionism or the labor movement's supposed to be. But it wasn't in her experience there, and I was like, you know, let's give ourselves a break here and try, you know, to live our lives with people who respect us and who pay attention to us and who care about us, you know. So I don't know what she ultimately decided to do, but I think for the first time in a lot of years I was finally getting through to her that it wasn't such a good deal. You know, the money was one thing, but the lifestyle sucked.
And that leaving is an option.
Right, and the
even though you've invested
option.
A lot,
right.
You
right.
can still
right.
change your course.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but
when
with
you,
me, it's not about unfinished business. And when I think back, it's interesting. I really think much less about the difficult times. You know, maybe this is a natural process of how one's memory, you know, kind of takes care of the pain from the past sometimes. Because when I think back, I think about being up on a roof and seeing a real pretty sunset. And I think about having some laughs with this one or that one. And, you know, for the most part, I think about the good times. And if I do... If something does remind me about difficult times of, you know, I mean, if somebody was really hostile to me, it was because that person was a hostile person anyway. I don't think my presence kicked up anything new in these people. I mean, the same guy who hated me hated blacks, hated Puerto Ricans, hated everybody, you know. And if something reminds me of those people, I just don't give a second thought about it. So I am remembering the good times over the bad, but I still know that it was not in all a positive experience for me to go through for the reason I mentioned, which is, like I said to Lori, you know, you can get another job, like this job at the fundraising place I'm at. Everybody is nice. Everybody speaks nicely to you. No one is threatened by your presence there. Nobody is playing practical jokes or trying to put the other guy down. There's no backbiting. There's no gossip. This is nice. And that's not what I experienced in construction.
What about feelings of accomplishment? I mean, you mastered a craft. First you got in it. You learned it. You mastered it. You did the work. Are you able to feel feelings of accomplishment about what you did and that you actually, aside from the fact that you don't consider yourself a pioneer, that you actually did do this rather remarkable thing.
Well, I don't know why in the first interview I said I didn't consider myself a pioneer. I mean, obviously I was.
Right.
You know, I was the first woman iron worker, at least in this half of the country.
I think it's your modest personality.
In the nation. Maybe, I really don't know why I said that. Because certainly I had political motivations for becoming an iron worker. You know, at the time, I had spent some years being very left-oriented politically, and part of that was to have kind of this romanticized, positive view of, you know, the working class and, you know, the noble proletarian or something, which, you know, I kind of think is a crock now. But, you know, I was clearly out there. I think I learned to deny it a lot when guys would ask me, you know, what are you trying to prove a point? And I'd say, no, I'm here for the money just like everybody else. But no, the fact is that I wanted to see if I could be part of the labor movement like that. And I wanted to, my biggest point probably had to do with the situation of women in the country, because I didn't think it was enough that women were breaking ground in terms of, you know, running an advertising agency or becoming an attorney or an executive for some sort of corporation. I felt that things weren't really going to change in this country until blue-collar women had the same experiences, had the same opportunities as men, until working-class women were being paid what working-class men were being paid. And the only way you do that is by going after the same job, because, you know, clearly, you know, the typist receptionist job where you spend 2/3 of your income on your wardrobe, you're never going to get anywhere. So, oh, sorry if that's your situation.
No, she can relate to that.
I can.
Low pay, lots of work.
Right.
Yeah.
And they expect you to dress like you're, you know, a cover girl or something.
Mm-hmm.
So do I feel a sense of accomplishment? I did accomplish a lot, you know. I did. Just to survive in that situation, I accomplished a lot. I guess I've broken ground that it'll be easier for other women to do the same. I think to the extent that other women came behind me in Local 580, it was easier for them. Especially when some of the guys started bringing their relatives in. I think one of the business agents had his niece in. And, you know, maybe I showed it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And this also gave them the freedom to try it out with their own family. You know, maybe had I not been there, he might have been fearful, you know, how is his niece going to fare in that situation. But I'll tell you, as far as what have I accomplished for my life, I have very mixed feelings because, you know, I've gone through some emotional turmoil or trauma or depression, or I don't really know how to characterize it, since I've moved away from New York. And to me, because I catch myself still worrying about, you know, thievery or getting mugged or whatever, to me it's almost like a little flashback, like I've suffered some sort of post-traumatic stress from having lived in New York. I don't know about the ironworker experience in particular, but I think that does add to it, because just as at times I didn't feel safe in my apartment, I didn't feel safe on the job. And then coming up here where I feel very safe and comfortable, the fears have kind of come surfaced, you know. It's just like I was on a college campus once where there were rats. And, you know, the exterminator put little pans of rat poison right in our rooms. And you wake up in the morning and you see half of it eaten. You know that there was a rat right there. But it wasn't until I moved out of that situation that I started having a series of dreams and nightmares about rats. So you see, the fears came to the surface.
It's interesting because you realize how much denial has to be a way of life in order to get through that life.
Right. And so I think, having toughed it out in New York, both as a woman and as an iron worker, has that built character? Does that make me feel strong, like I can accomplish this, I can conquer that? It hasn't had that effect. So I'm just really not sure what I've accomplished. Had I become proficient as a plumber, let's say, at least that's a trade that I could have brought here, continued working.
Yeah, it's not like you can go out and, you're next door and build a big building.
Right, or erect a steel staircase, in a one-story house. It's just not needed. So, I feel like I've taken very little away from there that's of use to me in another situation.
It just, what about ornamental ironwork and doing, renovation type on historic houses or fences, gates? Is there a demand?
It's not up here. It's just not up here. People build with wood. The fences are wood. The rails on your stair are wood. Mm-hmm. People have wood decks outside of their wooden houses with wooden stairwells. And people aren't worried about crime up here, so nobody has iron gates on their windows.
Yeah. So, in terms of the women's movement and your assessment of where women are at now, aside from the fact that there's this terrific economic recession, depression, and job loss through manufacturing jobs and, complete downturn in construction, aside from all of that, but what would you have to say about the situation with women and where the women's movement is, should be? What are your thoughts about women in general in terms of that, those goals that you had as a young woman?
Well, I think those of us who went into these different jobs, we affected and influenced those who saw us, who were around us, who spoke with us. As far as, did we spark any kind of national movement or something? I don't think so. I don't even think there's been many articles about us in, like, Ms. Magazine or other things. Now, I haven't been reading Ms. like I used to years past, but I don't know if anybody remembers that there are women doing these non-traditional jobs. Maybe, you'll change that. Uh-huh. But if we've had any broader effect, it's not something that right now in my experience I can measure. Mm-hmm. Certainly a lot of us have shown a lot of people that women can do a lot of these same jobs. But I think those who have gotten the most visibility are the women who have made a name for themselves as attorneys or politicians.
White collar. Would you say, though, that that the women's movement, from your point of view, has sort of neglected blue collar issues, blue collar women, or you don't feel that that's the case?
Well, I think the literature probably has, unless there's stuff that I just missed, because, like I say, I haven't been reading Ms. Magazine, I haven't been browsing, the women's studies section at the colleges either, I think probably in literature, yes. I know that, for a while now, used to be very involved in trying to help women get jobs. They help women get jobs on the docks in Brooklyn. But, how is this going to affect women in the future? Well, the fact of the matter is, in New York City at least, there aren't any of these. There's a dwindling supply of these well-paid type of jobs. And that's another reason why I soured on New York, because I think the future is very bleak for New York in terms of the working class or anybody who can't fit into the service industry with the, Wall Street kind of stuff, or business and finance, investments. It's becoming a complete service economy, where at one time people could get jobs on the docks, in auto plants, although maybe not right in the city.
Tarrytown,
Mahwah, New Jersey, other places in New Jersey, that's all closed up. The jobs on the docks are gone. The jobs in the breweries are gone. Construction is minimal. Just, you know, these are the good paying jobs for people with a 10th grade education or graduates in high school. And now I think they're turning out thousands of young men and women who aren't as educated as those who had a 10th grade education 20 years ago. Now they're more ignorant, less literate, and there's no jobs for these folks. And I think that's a very scary thing about New York. Where are these people going to be? They're going to be on the streets, as they are already, but only in record numbers as the years progress, I think, because nobody is creating jobs for these folks. Nor are they making a way for them to leave New York. You know, the current Republican Congress would probably love to eliminate Job Corps altogether. I don't even think Job Corps has been functioning like it used to, but at least that was an opportunity for a couple of kids to get out of New York and try something else. So, I mean, I think the city's going to go to hell completely when, you know, this whole new generation or two are coming up. These kids who are children of drug addicts and the mental and emotional problems they're going to have. Who's going to take care of them? Where are there going to be, you know, kind of simple types of jobs for these people to take on when they're adults? They're not going to have the capacity to compete with the intellects of, you know, people who went to suburban schools and who had a healthy upbringing, you know. Right. So,
have you in Massachusetts connected? Is there a women's movement here? Is there a movement? Is there some kind of left, which you've said, like, you know, that whole mythology of the working class heroes, sort of a crock? Mm-hmm. But have you connected to any kind of movement?
Well, there's a
movement?
Lot of alternative folks here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who don't match the Middle America status quo. This Pioneer Valley, although, you know, some of the farmers and the, I don't know, auto body shop mechanic type of guys, you know, tend to be a little redneck. This is, I mean, Northampton is a town that I think, Stevie, is it over 50% of the businesses in Northampton are owned by women?
Oh, I don't know that figure.
But
I'm not
high.
Sure. Oh, it's very
high. High, but I
and it's very unique.
Right.
And, you
well,
know.
You could find that out easily.
Yeah.
If you
just call the Chamber of Commerce in Northampton.
Okay.
But, you know, not only are there a lot of businesses run by women, gay people have a presence in Northampton. A lot of the businesses are run by lesbians or gay men. It's very open and accepted at Smith College, at the other colleges around. There's not a whole lot of minority folks. There's a fairly sizable international community around the University of Massachusetts and in Amherst. And Amherst is a very liberal town as well. In fact, one radio DJ pointed out that all the towns in Massachusetts voted Republican in this past election except for the People's Republic of Cambridge and the People's Republic of Amherst. You know, so there's a lot of leftists in Amherst, and you know, they have the Center for Economic
Policy
or something. Uh-huh. It's an organization to teach people economics.
Populist economics. That's
right.
In Somerville. Yeah.
It may be associated with the same, but it's there's one in Amherst.
Oh, great.
And, you know, there's food co-ops and people into organic farming and, I don't know, just a lot of, anti-status quo kind of thing. There's people who live up in this town, Wendell. There's a big women's community up there. And I guess you'd call them kind of leftover hippies, mm-hmm. you know, in some of these hill towns and this town north called Wendell where people live in little houses and then the extension is a Volvo and a school bus, you know. They're kind of hippie types. Mm-hmm. So it's really a very loose, you know, socially and politically it's very tolerant, very loose, and this area really celebrates its diversity. And people are real staunch about that, you know. And even folks that aren't necessarily that progressive, but they accept that. And Northampton and Amherst are also kind of a cultural capital for this whole Western Massachusetts. That on any given weekend, there's probably more to do in terms of listening to music, everything, folk, jazz, rock, different films and theater and stuff associated with the universities, or they're using the university facilities to bring in artists. There's sculpture and painting and all. It probably offers more than Springfield on any given night, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the jewel of the Pioneer Valley here as far as that goes. And like I say, the lesbian population in Northampton is just like it's getting establishment, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the city council people know that they're not allowed to make any anti-gay remarks. They're all hell break out, you know.
Yeah.
There was a story that this one gay woman was a victim of violence one night, and I mean, it actually turned out to not be true, but there were hundreds of people on the street in a candlelight vigil like a couple nights later, so.
Okay.
So it's a very comfortable place to live.
You feel comfortable and safe.
Mm-hmm.
And
unfortunately, the economy here isn't the greatest, and most jobs are $6 an hour jobs. If you're not a lawyer, a shrink, a medical doctor, a chiropractor, or a university professor, you know, you earn somewhere between $5.25 and $10 an hour.
The new America.
Yeah.
What are you thinking that personally for you this is a period of transition, like you're sort of processing your experience and then you're gonna sort of figure out what the next chapter of your life is? I mean, aside from living in Northampton, but you're still in the stage of working through and where you're going to go in
mm-hmm.
terms of, you know, psychologically.
Yeah. I mean, I hope I've worked through a lot of the negative stuff mm-hmm. or worked it out of my system as far as having left New York and mm-hmm. having what I call this post-traumatic stress syndrome. I hope that's behind me.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm in this job situation which feels very comfortable. I don't really have any big ambitions right now. I don't know if I'm going to stay there as an old lady or make some other move.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I just, you know, I feel like I've made it to third base or
mm-hmm.
whatever, and I'm just going to hang out here as
on
long as
base.
I can and
yeah.
just being comfortable, and whether I go for, you know, a home run or something new, I don't know at this point. But I'm just going to enjoy being comfortable, and you know, I'm making enough to survive, and that's
yeah.
it.
I have. With Janine Blackwelder in Chesterfield, Massachusetts, December 17th, 1994. Janine, recently I was talking to a woman who's making a film about trying to compare the first women who came into the trades with women who are coming in now, and they're calling it the second wave. And I'm wondering what you have to say about the experience of women who are coming in now, for those who are, I mean, the numbers are small, but...
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't met them. I'm not in that situation anymore, you know.
But you just think it's logical that it's got to be a lot different for them.
Well, I would think it would sometimes be easier. I think mm-hmm. they'll probably encounter all the same problems, you know. But I think, you know, to the extent that they run into companies that have had women before or individuals who have worked with women before, you know, some of the barriers have been broken down.
When you talk, you can talk to a tradeswoman without them bringing up the subject of thinking about leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you have some words of advice or some wisdom that you'd like to give to other women in terms of this question.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, I mean, except to say that if you're not happy, leave.
One
only
life
stay
to live.
If you're happy, if you think it's doing good for your life, you know. Like I say, in retrospect, I don't think it had a very positive impact on my life. I think I put myself in a position where I didn't get support, where, you know, oftentimes I felt like the only human on a planet of coneheads, and If there's another woman out there feeling like that, get out and stay out, you know. Even if it means earning less money, if you're around people who make you happy, that's a better deal. Mm-hmm. Now, if there's a woman out there who is enjoying her work and gets along fine with the guys, the only thing I would have to say to her is just remember that it's, you know, generally a very physical kind of work, and you have to prepare in some ways what you're going to do when you become 40, 45, 50. I mean, in the last several years I was an iron worker, I had chronic back pains and neck pain and all. I had had a couple of injuries, you know, during the period I worked. And it wasn't until I completely ceased all heavy physical work that I've been totally free of pain. I, you know, it's very rare now that I would have to go to a chiropractor or anything, whereas back then I really had to go about every week to keep pain free. And it's not just something particular to women, the men too. You know, after a certain number of years of being out in the bitter, bitter cold during the winter and doing a lot of heavy work, there's a lot of aches and pains that go with that, and maybe a guy who doesn't know anything else to do, you know, might stick it out. I don't know how many really stick it out to retirement. I don't remember seeing that many old guys. I think a lot of people became bartenders or got a, I don't know what they did, you know, buy a Dairy Queen franchise or something, you know, because it's not comfortable to keep that up until your old age, that's for sure.
Well, with the economy, there's also, men are faced with this transition also, trying to leave something that's been their life's work and
right.
go into another field, which is right. a hard thing to do.
It is.
There's another scenario, which is those women who are in the trades who are actually, like, in city jobs or in some place, even though that's jeopardized now also with layoffs,
mm-hmm.
but being in a situation where they've been making very good money and they've achieved a certain, you know, level in their work and their income, and they're used to that, but they're, you know, very unhappy,
mm-hmm.
and so that to leave is to give up that cash cow,
mm-hmm.
and that way of life, and but your advice is still be happy, right?
Right.
Do what makes you feel good rather
right.
than for the cause, proving it.
Right. I mean, I remember when I was at Ohio University as a freshman, I took an aptitude test, which I thought was going to test what particular skills I had or didn't have in various areas related to various occupations. And I was very angry when I realized that this whole test basically was testing you on what kind of people do you like to be around And what situations do you feel comfortable in? Are you more comfortable at a meeting with attorneys, or are you more comfortable, you know, I don't know, in a bar talking to truck drivers or something? Those weren't the questions, but that's kind of what it all boiled down to. And I was furious because I thought that that wasn't important at all. And now, you know, 20 years later, I can tell you that is very important, that your work takes up most of your life, most of your waking hours, really. You may only put in 8 hours, but in the time you take to prepare for work, to get enough rest for work, to make your lunch to take to work, to commute back and forth from work, if you're not enjoying the people that are around you, it does not make for the best quality of life, even if you're making pretty good money, because you're not in a happy situation. And it really, as it turns out, I found out, it matters a lot who you spend your time with, as far as what's on your mind, what you think about. What are those conversations like during the day? Are they making you a better person, or are they bringing you down because they're full of cynicism and negativity?
Well, I run out of questions, and thank you for the interview.
Okay. Let me know what the other gals say at some point.
I will.